It is my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education, and I'm so glad to be a part of this program. I think most of you know that Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing series. We have 10 in the fall and 10 in the spring, and we're moving right through our spring series, so I'm glad you're here, and I encourage you to look at the schedule that you can either find online if you don't have one or at the information desk to be sure that you don't miss any of these lectures that you're going to want to hear. Let's see. Next week, just to inform you, we're taking spring break along with the Fort Worth ISD and some of the other ISDs around here. So we will skip a week, and then we'll come back on Tuesday the 25th with Amelia Jones. And Amelia Jones is a writer and a contemporary and feminist art scholar. She's here to present Screen Eroticism, 1967 versus 1992, Exploration of Female Desire in the Work of Carol Lee Schneeman and Pipilotti Rist. See, I told you you're going to want to make these, so mark your calendar. This Tuesday evening presentation, Amelia Jones' presentation, is in conjunction with her visit as the Green Honors Chair Scholar to TCU, where she will follow her lecture here with Aesthetics, Identity, Art, History, maybe slightly milder, on Wednesday, the 26th at 5 p.m. in North Mowdy, room 132. And if you want to ask me later about that, I'll be happy to give you that information again. This is actually provided for TCU students, but it's my understanding that the public is welcome to join them at 5 next on Tuesday the 26th. So I encourage you to try to make that Tuesday evening and then possibly to follow up with the lecture at TCU on that Wednesday. Tonight, I am so happy that we were able to find time in the busy schedule of artist Joshua Mosley. Most of you will recall that Joshua was the first artist featured in this year's Focus exhibitions with his installation of film and sculpture and accompanying drawings titled Avu. Joshua is known for work such as Avu, in which he combines animated films with sculptural objects as philosophical meditations that integrate and reflect his own interest in poetry, film, and music, and philosophy. Joshua was actually born in Dallas. I don't know if he lived here for all that long, but he was born in Dallas. But he now lives and works in Philadelphia, where in addition to being an artist, he is Associate Professor of Fine Arts in the School of Design at the University of Pennsylvania. He received an MFA and a BFA from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and he has a solo exhibition this year at the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego. And in recent years, he has had solo exhibitions at the Donald Young Gallery, where his work is represented in Chicago. The Gegenwartskunst, in Basel, Switzerland, and at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia. Group exhibitions have included the 52nd Venice Biennale, Think with the Senses, Feel with the Mind, Art in the Present Tense, which was curated by Robert Storr, where Joshua showed the 2007 piece Dread, another seemingly simple film that upon inspection is incredibly complex and thoughtful in its methods and its message, and accompanied by bronze sculptures that challenge one's sense of scale and perception. In addition to the latest Venice Biennale, Joshua was included in the 2002 Art Basel and has since been included in shows in Barcelona, Madrid, and Germany. Recognized with the Joseph H. Hazen Rome Prize, the Pew Fellowship in the Arts, the Lewis Comfort Tiffany Foundation Award, and the Pennsylvania Council of the Arts Fellowship, Joshua was tagged the thinker in an art review article by the same title, in which he was identified as one of the stars of this year's Venice Biennale. Besides his enduring commitment to his own work, Joshua has a sincere and insatiable interest in animation of all stripes. He has graciously agreed to curate frame-by-frame animation at the Modern that opens tomorrow night at 7 p.m. and runs Thursday and Saturday. I hope that you received, and I think everybody in here did because I was guarding the door, the lineup when you came in tonight. If not, you can certainly pick one up on the way out. Joshua will be, in addition to talking about his own work, which he will do for the most part of the presentation, he is going to give a brief introduction to the films that are in that series and why he has selected them. It's fascinating. You can look at the list, I think, and see that. He also mentioned that Wednesday is going to be a particularly nice night for kids, if anybody's interested. Thursday, he said, is also interesting, but maybe slightly darker. He can talk a little bit more about that. And then Saturday is the animation that I think you've probably seen quite a bit of press on. It's a pretty famous piece. So with that, I want to let Joshua get started so he can tell us about his work and how he comes to these beautiful pieces, and then also brief us a little bit on the film series that he's been kind enough to curate. So with that, please join me in welcoming Joshua Mosley.
Thank you. And thanks for coming. I want to start by screening a piece that I completed in about 2000. This was about a three-year project. I started by writing a poem, and then I drew some pictures. I worked with composers and people who speak Arabic in Beirut, where my grandfather's from, to translate the poem to Arabic. And I'll tell you more about that process after we watch the film. But the basic point is that the music was recorded first, and then I completed the animation next, and that the music is based on my poem. The poem, I'll screen it, and then we'll talk more. We can take the lights down. The first one might take a second, but it will be up.
هالحكي بلا هالحكي شو يا حمص فول يا فول حابل بالنابل بالمكيول تغير اللون حمص يا حمص فول يا فول حمص يا حمص فول يا فول حابل بالنابل بالمكيول تغير اللون
جيب الخبز وفخ دجاج
فيش لون نعنع وخيار شراب نبيل وحاجة طير
ما نسأل
لا لما تفكر وتقول حمص يا حمص فول يا فول
على ورق الصف صاف
صيف صاف صف صاف
من وزن وخفة من خطوط رقة من وزن وخفة من خطوط رقة
جذور بتحفر وريش بيسقط
تخطر أفكار
بترندح أشعار شو بتزيد شو بتفيد
لما نتلاحظ اشيا صغيرة اشيا كبيرة
النور بيتحول
لا كل شي بيغير طريقه الحب فين الحب فين
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about this piece before I go on and show more. I was thinking about, when I wrote the poem, I was thinking about a conversation that could have happened between my great-grandfather and my grandfather. And I was thinking of the character of the donkey was sort of inspired by the etchings that Goya did of donkeys talking to each other with small captions. It was around the time where I started to teach, and I was thinking about the kind of conversations that happen between either a parent and a child, or a grandparent and a great-grandparent, or a teacher and a student. The donkey in Beirut, when I was through talking to translators and musicians and other artists while I was working there, I learned that it had two sort of symbolic meanings. One was that it was a stubborn creature, and that the other one was that there was something really good about a donkey, that it would approach a problem or a situation without having prior knowledge. So it would be able to look at a problem kind of like a child. So I thought that sort of pushed the project a little bit for me, because I thought about this donkey without prior knowledge talking to a child without prior knowledge, and having them take opposite points of view. It's kind of arbitrary opposite points of view on seven different topics. And I thought that the topics could be all topics that would need to be discussed between a great-grandfather and a grandfather. My grandfather was killed in a bombing. My great-grandfather was killed in a bombing when my grandfather was six, so this would be the last conversation that they could have had before my grandfather left Beirut for his mother to be remarried. I wrote the poem in English, and then worked with a friend to translate it to Spanish, and then worked with a third friend to translate it back to English again, because I thought that I was reading these Spanish translations of short stories and poems. And I was interested in the way that the subject of the sentences would move to the end of the sentence. So for example, around the corner came the bus. So the it would sort of leave you in suspense until the subject was there. So it was kind of an experiment. And once I got it back to English, then I proposed this project and got funding to go to Beirut to work with a filmmaker friend and some other connections that she, a playwright who's also a video artist now, and then a composer. And we worked for about 3 weeks translating it to Arabic. It was detailed, and there were a lot of decisions and a lot of conversations about the content of the piece that had to be worked out just during that translation. I worked with Tufi Farouk to produce the music, and he's a musician who's from Beirut and works in Paris as a jazz musician. And I became familiar with his music before going, and then was able to meet him there. He was actually on vacation, and I ruined his vacation, so he worked with me for 3 weeks. I went to school at the Art Institute, as Terry said, and I studied art and technology. And one of the things that I struggled with while I was in school was figuring out exactly how much I wanted to deal with the technology in the way that I would be building on the history of artists who had worked with technology. And one thing that they had done is wrote programs that simulated nature. So if you look through, for example, like the journal Leonardo, and you look through the last 30 years, you'll see a lot of artists that are thinking about nature and how a computer program could mimic nature or mimic a mind or artificial intelligence and these sorts of things. So I thought, I always think about that as I'm working. And then there's the practical sense of getting the animation done. And I started to really oppose the idea of mimicking nature with a computer program. And I'll get to that point at the end of the lecture. But during this time, I wanted to build that bowl of rice with a program that would pull the grains of rice together until they came into clumps, and then use a gravitational simulation to drop the rice grains into the bowl to sort of build up the system. And then for the water, these are the Arabic numerals 1 through, or 0 through 9. And it's a sort of a morphing animation where they turn into L shapes. And the and that's sort of moving with a dynamic simulation to create a sense of water, like an abstraction of water. The next piece I'm going to show relates a lot to the pieces that I chose for the next couple of nights in this frame by frame festival. With this piece, this is the first piece where I started to really combine different kinds of materials. And I used clay puppets with hand-drawn charcoal backgrounds. I guess after I completed this piece, I started thinking about the disconnect between the body and the environment, or between the mind and the body. And that's sort of a result of, when I started this piece, it was an experiment. After I started watching it and working on it, I realized that the characters were really being set off from the landscape and that it had a certain effect. The idea for the piece that I'm going to show next was kind of this drive across central Illinois that my other grandfather would take every day. And I was trying to get away from the idea of making a piece about my other grandfather after just making a piece about the first grandfather. So I wanted to really keep it focused on the psychological state that I imagined my grandfather to fall into, someone who drives 40 minutes or an hour every day to work and an hour home. And he's looking at these fields of corn and soybeans go by, and they're changing slowly over seasons. And I was just sort of imagining that the same as someone who does yoga every morning or someone who meditates every day, and the kind of thought process that can go on, the sort of purity of that thought process that would go on over 20 or 30 years. At the same time, this is around 2002, MCI and AT&T introduced the unlimited phone plans, this is actually in Philadelphia. There's a sense, I didn't have a phone until a couple of years ago, and there's this sense, like when I was in the park, that these people were completely disconnected with the place that they were in, and they were connected to someone else and in the common space in terms of their conversation, but it's as if the park just started to disappear, and I was sitting there and other people were connecting outside of the park. And I started to think about that relationship in terms of meditation as well. But also in terms of a disconnect, those people actually kind of having this glazed over environment that where their mind is becoming disconnected with the place that they're in. I was reading Descartes' correspondences, the letters that he wrote to friends, and there's some strange moments in the letters where he talks about gravity and the way that the gravity as it's For example, a bird, as it's flying and it gets higher and higher up in the air, the gravitational pull becomes weaker and weaker, and that's why the bird can fly so far. And so he had these general kinds of trains of thought where he would go into that, sort of that, go into that state and end up with somewhat silly results. And I was sort of interested in the way that, even if you were thinking scientifically in a way, the way that the creativity could come into it, and the space of that, the way that you could distance yourself and maintain thought. So I'll show this piece, and then I'll talk about the festival.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's turn up the lights just slightly, just that kind of medium low setting. Thanks. I just want to make sure some people are still here. Okay, now we can go down a little darker. I want to talk a little bit about the festival. I wanted to put together some of the pieces. I guess it wouldn't be honest to say that these are all the pieces I've ever been inspired by, because partly because I'm inspired by all kinds of work that I look at, films and animations and paintings and sculpture and things that I read and whether it's art or not. But these are pieces that are really important that I've discovered, and some of them are inside of the art world, things that you would see in museums or galleries, but most of these are not things that you would see in museums and galleries. They kind of operate in a parallel world, film festivals and I think everyone who works, all of these people consider themselves to be artists, and wouldn't exact. Some of them would call themselves animators, but most of them would call themselves artists. George Griffin is someone who has been a key figure in the experimental animation scene in New York for the last 30 something years, and since the late 60s, I think. And this is an early piece called Head that combines some photographs, but also these cutout pieces of paper that he drew and painted onto. And what you're seeing on the right looks like a flip book, but actually it's shot one frame, and then he changes the page and then shoots another frame, and that becomes part of his film. He also he's continued to work, and I've been able to meet him, and it's been really interesting. This is a piece about him, his relationship with his daughter. The basis of the film is putting his daughter to bed, but it's kind of half from her perspective and half from his perspective, and the way that he uses the animation is kind of to transition quickly from one perspective to the other, and it seems to be based on an actual recording of him and his daughter sort of going through this routine. Susan Pitt, if I can remember right, I think she'd be on the second night, but I'm not positive. I don't know what to say. But it's not always happy animation. And I was talking to my wife about animation. She said all experimental animation is just depressing, and because I always get DVDs in the mail, and then I'll rip them open and we'll put them on TV, and my son's there, and she's like, this is just all of these experimental. Well, she really deals with sort of in this piece, I think there's a sense of depression, there's a sense of really going against the grain of like a psychological state, and then there's this goofy kind of Mickey Mouse character that really kind of connects back to the history, to Mickey Mouse, and then also to some goofy early animation. Norman McLaren is one of the key figures in the history of animation in Canada. And in Canada, there's a National Film Board, and they've supported a great deal of animation, especially artists who are working with experimental techniques of combining different materials, over the last, I'd say, 40, 50 years. One thing that's sort of seemed like a continuous mission with the National Film Board has been that they seem to give an importance to there being a social message with every piece. This one's called Neighbors, and it's not going to be in the festival maybe some of you have seen it, but a lot of the projects that they've supported by independent artists, and they actually produce, and it seems like that there's kind of a mission that the film board has so that there's a public service kind of message to each piece. This piece is also by Norm Macdonald. What just happened? The system says shut down. My computer's on, John, but the system says shut down. I'll continue to talk about that piece. So that colorful piece that you saw there was a... What he did is he made the soundtrack. Raise your hand if you know what an optical soundtrack is. There's a couple of people. It's with film, like 35 millimeter and 16 millimeter film. Traditionally, for a long time, the way that the sound was recorded was through an optical track. And he made the visuals for this optical track, and light goes through the track on the film. And then that produces the vibrations of that image, of the on and off as it's passing through the sound reader, creates the sound. So he created the soundtrack visually that would interrupt this beam of light in the projector, and then made a visual analog to it in the image. So there's a complete synchronization, and what you're actually looking at is the soundtrack. But it's incredibly colorful, and it looks like something someone would do digitally. I want to see if this is going to get better. It's kind of weird.
Stop getting a signal from your laptop.
Oh wait, here we come. Okay, wonder what happened there. Okay, maybe it was my fault. Okay. So here's another still from that. So what you're actually seeing is a colorized representation of the soundtrack, and the frequency, the vertical frequency of these marks relates to, I think, pitch, and the horizontal frequency relates to volume. Also from the National Film Board, there's an artist, Caroline Leaf. She's produced a lot of pieces, and I think we have two of them. The goose and the duck and the street, and the street was done with. You can see on the top right, she's painting with her fingers, and it's oil sort of smudged onto glass frame by frame. And what's terrific about it is just the way that sort of the position of the camera kind of shifts from one place to another, and the way that's done by frame, and the subtlety of the color. This is a story about two kids and their grandmother passing away. And it's sort of a Jewish family. Then this is a much more recent piece produced by Film Board in Canada, and it's called Aria. It's about this Asian woman puppet that... meets sort of a Barbie-like American soldier puppet, and they have a kid that kind of is born like a fish, and then at the end of it, something bad happens, and she runs off the set of the puppet animation and starts to dismantle her body and take apart her armature and sort of tears herself apart. This is Winsor McKay is key along with the French trick filmmaker Méliès in my mind in connecting early animation with the vaudeville, and but the piece that I picked doesn't really do that. It's a weird one. He made Gertie the dinosaur. If you've seen that, it's an early dinosaur animation. Dinosaur throws rocks into the lake. The one I picked was called Fragment of the Centaurs, Fragments of the Centaurs. So I guess the name of the film is The Centaurs, and he didn't finish it. But you can see that this centaur is throwing a rock at a bird. And I like, and it's sort of this collage animation of hand drawn in the forest. And then we're hoping that Disney comes through and actually gets the two Disney films. One, they're both Ugly Duckling, and I'm gonna I think we're doing either one each night or putting them together. But it actually, this one is 1927, and I got the date wrong, and this one's 1931. And that's during that time, there's a huge transformation of the style of motion and the style of the characters. And it's really interesting to see these two pieces together. And I like to look at this one with my students when I teach, because the motion in this one is pretty much what they're, if they go and work in the industry, the motion in this one is really, is influenced the way the animation, the way the Pixar, what your Pixar, if you work at Pixar, what your director is going, your animation director is going to be telling you is going to be based on the transition that happened during those 4 years and the kind of movement that showed up in this film. Then there's four pieces, or three or four pieces by people that I've worked kind of closely with. And this is Chris Sullivan, who teaches at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, and who I've been in touch with since I graduated. And this is a piece he completed just before I worked with him in 1987. It sort of has a... I think his work has a bit of mythology to it, but has real characters. And he doesn't give up. He works in Illinois or in Chicago, and he doesn't give up the sense that he works regionally in a specific place, and makes work. I think this piece might be either this piece or the next piece is kind of set in Pittsburgh, or around in the or the suburbs of Detroit, or certain very specific areas, and makes work about specific places. And I think that was kind of inspiring for me. I graduated with Sungyeong Jo, produced this piece during school. Actually, that date is wrong. It should be 2000, called Grandmother. And she sent this into Sundance, and it was in the Sundance Festival, and then got a job at Pixar and has been there for 10 years. Laura Height teaches at the at CalArts in California, and look for me is a piece about her being invisible for a day, and it's cut out paper, but it's actually done with computers, using actual cut out paper and then bringing it into the computer. Larry Jordan is one of my favorites, and we have a piece called The Orb, and this is not a still from The Orb. I think he's from San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken, and he's been working since the 60s. And the thing that really moved me about when I was reading about his history when I was in school was that he produced a feature film. I think it must have been in the early 90s. And it took him about 2 years, and he would work on it every day and add more to the animation. And he had no sense of where it was going. And he couldn't always remember what he had done a couple weeks ago. He was just building on it and letting it flow. And there's something about the confidence there of knowing, of keeping on and going, with the idea and seeing where the ideas will take you, that I thought was inspiring. I'm not that bold, and I think it's really important actually to take a step back every once in a while. But I think that it's hard to move forward with animation without having some of the qualities that he has, and then also sometimes the work is pretty great. And the final day will be this piece by Lott Reininger from 1926 called The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, based on one of the tales of the Arabian Nights. She's using cutout paper that's backlit. It's shot black and white. In some of the shots, there's bits of sand that's creating an atmospheric effect. After the entire film was shot, it was colorized, and the different sections of the film have different sort of color tones to them. The film was lost, I think, during the war, and it showed one copy of it showed up in the I think mid 90s or late 90s. and was restored and recolorized, and the music was re-recorded for it. And so it's been shown a lot across the United States, but I'm not sure that everybody's seen it, and it was a pretty terrific thing to see. So those are some of the films. There'll be a couple more. So let's see. I'd like to show my newest work and then take a couple of questions if I can. Thank you. Thank you. I know that I'd say I would take questions, but I want to show a couple more pictures of the way that piece was installed, so that you'll get a sense of what it looked like in the context there. The first room, the way that it was installed, had these bronze sculptures, and you can kind of get a sense of scale there. And then through the next room was this large projection, so that there's these sort of solid black objects, and then the figures in the animation show up as sort of white shells. The two characters, you learn... I probably should have told you this ahead of time, but I don't know if it makes a difference. This is Pascal, and you would learn that by the wall text, and this is Rousseau. So you would learn the name of these historical characters first, and then you would go into the next room. But I tried to make it so that it wouldn't rely on knowing who they were necessarily. So I'd love to take questions if anyone has any questions.
Could you please tell me a little bit about the technique or the technical side of this animation?
Of this last one? Or of all of them?
How it's created. I know before you do animation with them with the Super 8.
I'll show a couple of pictures. It might be better than a lot of words. Just keep it a little bit dimmer, even for a second. This one, I made these sculptures out of clay and produced casts in plaster, and worked with a foundry that 3D scanned them. This machine is a 3D scanner, and it's getting depth information, and so it's getting a digital sort of shell of thousands and thousands of measurements. And so this is about 2 million measurements. It's like a digital surface. And that I reduced so that you could actually see some of the material quality using the computer. The backgrounds are photographs that I shot in the forest in Hawaii. And instead of just shooting one, I shot six, and I just sort of held down the trigger of the camera. So it went click, 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 click. So they're just slightly different. You can see the movement there. And what I did in the animation is I cycled those pictures, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and it looks like the stuff is moving back and forth, the environment. Then there's a lot of hand masking. I'll show you another picture here, where I'm cutting out the tree, and I made that by hand. I sort of, in Photoshop, drew around the edges of the tree so that I could layer the characters into that and kind of make the movement work behind the tree using 3D animation. So I'm using the same tools that Pixar uses for 3D animation, in a sense, but combining it with digital photography and a lot of shot-by-shot kind of drawing around objects to get the figures to fit into those environments.
And the charcoal that you did in the background, you combined the other, was that similar, the same way?
Yeah.
I was surprised that wasn't floating. I mean, it really looked like it was grounded. So.
Yeah, I have a little sort of... For most of these environments, this is from Avu that was in the Focus exhibition, this is the factory. And so I designed this factory on the right with computer modeling. And then I made a computer rendering of the factory, printed it out on my laser printer three times, then did watercolor drawings. I did three watercolor drawings, and I tried to make them almost as similar as possible, and you saw some of those in the exhibition. Then shot the characters against a green screen, a color that's really different than their clothes. And with the computer, I was able to isolate that green and say, I want that green to be transparent. And so that goes out. And then sometimes I would, you can see that the shadows of her feet kind of remain. I might have just taken that as a hint and hand put them in. But I think that shadows really help sort of seat the characters in the space. It seems to take as long to sort of come up with the idea as it does to produce it. And most of these projects have been about the commute was maybe 14 months, and the longest one, Beirut, that I showed first was about 3 years. But in conjunction with teaching, I'm not able to do this full time. Dread was about a 2-year project.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I use a program that makes all green transparent.
Okay.
And sometimes that's a problem because if too much green becomes transparent, then it starts to chew on the characters. And then they, you know, like if they have a green apron on, then the woman with the green apron and Avu, I had to put her on a blue screen. Yeah.
Your first film, why did you choose to change it to a different language if you wrote it in English first?
Well, the first idea, I wrote it in English because my first idea was that it would be a conversation between my great-grandfather and my grandfather, and that it would have been in Arabic. I wrote it in English because that's the way that I was thinking, and it was the most immediate way to do it. I translated it to Spanish because I was kind of interested in the poetry that I was reading, and I was interested in sort of the shifts that would happen. And I thought of it as a collaborative process where you bounce something off of another person you're working with, and they come back with some weird idea, and then you can, if you're in a collaborative situation where you're the bossy one, then you can say, okay, I like that one, but I don't like this one. And I was in that situation throughout this process. I wouldn't really call it a collaboration because I was the one who would either accept or decline the contributions. So partly it was, with the Spanish translation, it was to shake it up. And with the Arabic translation, it was to get it into the correct language. I also found there's a lot of things that didn't translate. I was thinking about, and this is, I guess you have a good question in an entirely other sense, that one thing I was thinking about was the difference between, if one of the sections of the film is appetite, what really turns me on in terms of food, and what would be the parallel that would turn my grandfather on in terms of food. So there was that translation that I would never know about. And like andouille sausage, you can't say it in Arabic. Or black-eyed peas, maybe andouille sausage you can, but black-eyed peas you can't. So we changed it to fool, which is like a different dish. So you have to have a lot of graduate students make films about going home. And I didn't do this as a graduate student, but a lot of students make films about going home or going to where their ancestors are from and thinking about what is it that makes them somewhat from that place but also different because they're living in the United States. And so I tried to think about, I was thinking somewhat in the back of my mind about that translation. Yeah. At first, it was because that would involve there's two reasons, I guess, and I don't When I considered making a fifth puppet, you know, that would be like buying a fifth armature, building a, you know, the clay around it and putting it into the... It seemed to... Like, I sort of, you know, worked out that scenario in my mind of... Because there's a forklift that drives through the scene and there's nobody in it. And I thought, in a way, it's really interesting that the whole factory's empty and this woman works there. And that there's this vacancy there. So... I had a lame way of rationalizing not to make the character. You know, you could say, you can leave and you can say whatever you want. But there is a important, I mean, I think that when you add another character, yeah, I think that's what it was, is that that I liked the vacant sort of sense of that factory, and that it was, that it, you know, another thing, that piece for me kind of was about communication and how it was such a big industry, and then at the same time it wasn't really connecting people together, and so there's sort of an absence there too. I mean, I could probably go on and make up a bunch of reasons, but I thought it was okay. I mean, in the same sense, like, I muted the sound in Commute, and all of a sudden it reminded me of a film that I'd seen by Jacques Tati. It's a French filmmaker, and there's this scene in it where a guy sort of walking around and pacing around this lobby, and he sits on cushions, and the cushions make sound, but it's like his footsteps don't, and he's talking or something, and you can't hear that. You only hear the sound of the compression of the foot. And I liked, like, the isolation of that in the sense of what I was thinking about was the way that cell phones kind of remove you from space. So that was a great question. Thanks. Yeah.
Can you talk about the use of subtitles? Like, in this film, earlier you had spoken about how you wanted a middle America, you wanted a very specific voice for this, but can you return to subtitles? Can you maybe address that a little bit?
In the first film, I'll kind of go through them because I think I've been changing each time. In the first film, Beirut, it was interesting to translate the Arabic back to English and then have subtitles. I was interested in the poem remaining a poem and being text, and I think that that's something that's been continuous each time that I've used it, is that I wrote the text, and I like working on the image and then having a parallel text so that it, because it seems to transform so drastically when it goes from your script to the character's mouths, in terms of the way that it reads. When I read things or when I hear them, it's such a different experience for me. So having the image and the text that's coming out of their mouths is my experience of French films, and there's some kind of interesting parallel processing that's happening there where the mind of the character is abstracted into a completely different kind of different medium or sort of writing. So that I think that's one thing for it. In the last piece, I use the I'll show you a quick slide of this. I used the font from the book that I was reading by Pascal called Pensées, which is sort of a collection of small fragments of thoughts that he had that were unpublished at the time of his death. So anyway, I scanned this book that was published by Harvard, I think in the 40s or 50s, and then scanned several different letters, different types, and tried to not reuse reuse letters to handset the text. And in this case, I wanted them to be speaking from their minds, directly from their minds, just like they would be writing, so that there was a more direct connection. There was a precision. It seems like when words come out of your mouth, sometimes there's not the same kind of precision as when you are writing, especially when Pascal is writing Pensées or Rousseau. They're reading over it and having a recursive self-checking kind of processes. And so I think the succinctness of the dialogue seems to have something to do with the fact that it's text. But it's been my instinct each time I question whether I should continue to do it. I don't want to be in a pattern of always thinking that's the way to do it, but I feel like it's sort of been shifting. Another thing that shifted was the widescreen format. all of a sudden, which I liked working in compositionally, now all the screens are widescreen. And so there's not a little black nice space below to hang the text in. So it has to be sort of composited into the image. And then so with this piece, I started to experiment with where it would sit within the image and how it would melt into it or not melt into it. So that's part of the reason I got into this analog kind of scanning system. Is that? Do you want to refine? I don't know if that answers the question. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about your experience about being selected for the Venice Biennale and like how far in advance and did you get to select exactly what you were going to have in it or how much input did the curator have with what you were contributing?
I would say that it was roughly a year in advance that I had a sense that that Robert Storr was interested in this particular piece that was in the middle of production, and much of his decision was based on my past work and a verbal description of this work. At some point, I showed him a rough version, and that I think that helped him think about the way it would be positioned in terms of the in terms of the bronzes and the video and how it should be within the larger exhibition. Obviously you can read about all of the complexities of curating that exhibition in terms of the budget and those sorts of things. From my perspective, it seemed like a difficult exhibition to pull off on a low budget. And so, and I think it was well installed, and I was really happy with how it was installed there. And so, to put it shortly, I didn't know what was going on for a long time because he was working on it so hard, and I think that's the general experience it was good for me because I just worked hard, thinking that it might happen for a long time, and I was really happy when it was. Supported in the way that it was in terms of the technology for it and the positioning of it.
So Ben, did you as an artist go over there during the opening? And what was that experience like to be amongst all those other artists?
Well, I simultaneously.
What was the Biennale experience like from an artist's perspective, I guess?
Simultaneously, I was on fellowship for a year in Rome. So I was able to go before the opening and actually get a sense of the space because I hadn't attended one before. I also was able to go to the Architectural Biennale in October. I was able to see the actual buildings and see the way that technology was installed by default, so to speak, by people who aren't so sensitive to color, light, and I'm not saying that architects aren't. I'm just saying that when you're a video artist, or at least, some of the videos I know are a little bit more focused on the specifics of the installation. Architects are creative and sharp too, but we have different specs. So I got to see what sort of the default support was, and I think that was helpful. The opening the installation was really interesting. It was interesting to see how it's different in Italy in terms of getting screws or getting bolts and nuts and that kind of paint and working with the people there. The opening was really exciting. I felt invisible, and saw a lot of people that looked familiar, looked like famous people, and it was really nice to sort of be in the corner and hear complete strangers talking about about a certain, my work in a German or something, and trying to guess what they're saying. And, it was interesting. It was nice. It was also great to meet some of the artists that I had read about and seen their pieces, but had never sort of seen during the installation. That was a really unique kind of experience. In the back.
How do you develop and think about and kind of work your script? I'm interested in your writing kind of process.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately because I'm in the middle of trying to write one. And usually I spend some time at the library. I spend some time on the web in terms of tracking down things that I think are... I guess I look for key images, but mostly kind of key concepts that I think are really specific to the moment now, and things that have sort of been the kinds of things, the kind of thoughts that are going on in my head for a year or so. For example, right now I'm thinking about... It started with thinking about the way that a fiscal conservative could be fiscally conservative but simultaneously accept other sort of principles within a belief. Basically the way that you could accept a lot of beliefs within one mind, some which you agree with, others which you accept. Same with a Democrat. There could be certain issues that are important to you, and you could just go kind of wholeheartedly accept the other issues without really scrutinizing. Now it's that idea is sort of shifting more into how you could hold a contradiction in your mind. So I started. I'm wandering and looking for things that are not from right now that will help me clarify exactly what I want to do, because I don't think it's the first thing. I think that's what I thought I wanted to do for the last 8 months or so, and it's just thinning out for me, I'm more interested in the way that the mind could sort of hold these complex contradictions, and I'm reading something. I think his first name is Richard Sennett. Richard Sennett. It's The Culture of New Capitalism. It's a book, and I'm reading it slowly, like. Just a page at a time, and thinking about it and wondering whether it's going to trigger anything. Then I'll start writing notes, and I put a date in Microsoft Word, and I write a bunch of notes. And then usually I take a nap. Some kind of story that's a structural thing comes up in my mind. In a dream sort of thing, and it's not enough because it doesn't contain everything, but it contains a lot of it. And then I write that down, and I figure out, can it be layered? Can I work on it more? And then I start to draw pictures, and then I try to order the pictures, and then I try to layer it more and read more so that I feel that I have the topic as fully covered as I can. When I was in Rome, I was able to talk about Pascal and Rousseau with a lot of the scholars that were there. And in a way, it helped me. They challenged some of the things that I was having them say, or who was taking which position, or who got killed by the dog. Those kinds of things, those conversations were useful. So sometimes it happens through the conversations. I usually start more wordy and then start to eliminate the words. And I go ahead and layer it on top of the images. And edit the text after it's already been put into the picture as I watch it. with this last one, I wrote it on Post-it notes and sort of came up with a lot of possibilities. I actually produced the music first, so the blah blah blah, and I had to come up with the three words that would fit into that would sort of encapsulate what Pascal was going to say. And I came up with a lot of different Post-it notes of what the possibilities of blah 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 was, and kept switching them out until I kind of got a conversation that seemed like it was covering this issue of how do you grapple with the complexity of nature and whether or not God exists, and when you're overwhelmed, what do you do? Yeah.
What 3D animation software did you use, and the rendering, did that really hinder a lot of your the time that it took you to finish these things, in Beirut? That was timing was a key factor, and just the rendering process being so long and everything.
I used Maya for all of these projects in Beirut. I started with Softimage. At the time, that was what was used. I teach animation, so I'm fairly efficient when it comes to working, but it does take a long time, and that gives me, it's a good way. Some people think of it as a long time that you're waiting, but I also think I have a family, and I think of it as a way that when I'm with my family, my work is kind of getting done. I'm eating dinner, but two or three computers are rendering, so work is still being done. So it's a very good feeling. Yes. Yeah.
Do you attribute that to?